What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. North Korea's state news agency says the country will further develop its self-defense nuclear weapons capability. The announcement comes following the third day of a rare Workers' Party Congress in Pyongyang. RAND Corporation Korea analyst Bruce Bennett says there's been no reason for the North to have such weapons.
How much do they need nuclear weapons if conventional weapons used to handle the problem just fine? And the answer is probably not any, but certainly not more than a few. And if they have more than a few, they're not purely defensive. They're starting to field an offensive capability. And that's bad news for North Korea because they may eventually push the U.S. to do something about it.
Sunday, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un said the country would not use nuclear weapons unless its sovereignty was threatened. He also reportedly prepared to normalize relations with hostile nations and called for talks with South Korea to reduce distrust and potential misunderstandings. The North Korean leader also outlined a five-year plan to boost the country's economy. The death toll from the April 29 apartment building collapse in Nairobi, Kenya, has now risen to 49. 140 others were rescued from the rubble of the six-story structure that had been condemned but not yet torn down. Its collapse followed days of heavy rains. The owners of the building were questioned by police and then released on bail. Malian special forces have arrested a suspected jihadist leader in southern Mali. Yacouba Touré is believed to be the second highest-ranking member of the terrorist Al-Qaeda-affiliated group on Sardine. He's been linked to several attacks in Mali and Burkina Faso. Touré described as one of the main suppliers of logistics assistance and weapons to jihadists in southern Mali. This is VOA News. Here's finally some encouraging news about the huge wildfire raging in Alberta, Western Canada. Premier Rachel Notley says the fires are a lot smaller than originally thought. Alberta Wildlife Authority Manager Chad Morrison said the weather is also helping firefighters gain control of the blaze.
As of yesterday, there's 34 fires still burning in the province, but I can happily report as well that 31 of these fires are now either being held or brought under control.
As of midday Sunday, more than 160,000 hectares in northern Alberta were still burning. The fire wiped out nearly the entire city of Fort McMurray, forcing 90,000 residents to evacuate. Greek lawmakers approved a controversial package of pension and tax reforms demanded by the country's European creditors in exchange for nearly $100 billion in bailout cash. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras defended the reforms as sustainable and fair. They aim to reduce the highest pension payouts while increasing contributions for those in medium and high income brackets. The legislation also seeks to ensure a 3.5% budget surplus by 2018. Voters in the Philippines are electing a new president today. Polls show the controversial mayor of Davao, Rodrigo Duterte, is the surprise favorite. Duterte, known for his profanity-filled speeches against the government and threats to murder criminals. East-West Institute analyst Gerard Finnan says progress in reform has been too slow for many people.
Rule of law and human rights have improved, the economy has been growing, and the Philippine military has once again accepted the principle of civilian rule. What people seem to, in some cases, be dissatisfied with is the pace and direction of change in the Philippines.
The Constitution limits the president to a single six-year term. Outgoing leader Benigno Aquino, credited with turning the Philippines into one of Asia's most thriving economies. Hundreds of rescuers searching for more than 40 missing construction workers who disappeared during a landslide in Fujian province in southern China. Workers were at the scene of a hydropower project when heavy rains caused a massive rock and mudslide that buried their living quarters. Unidentified gunmen shot and killed a prominent Pakistani rights activist known for speaking out against the Taliban and other Islamist groups. Kuran Zaki killed late Saturday in a drive-by shooting in the southern city of Karachi. Three Spanish journalists missing in Syria for 10 months arrived in Madrid safely Sunday. The three, Antonio Pampliega, Jose Manuel Lopez, and Angel Sastre, disappeared last July after crossing from Turkey and Syria with the aim of reporting on the fighting in Aleppo. Lebanese went to the polls Sunday under tight security for municipal elections in Beirut and the Baikal Valley, voters selecting a 24-seat municipal council to run Beirut's affairs. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today's Monday, May 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Democratic Republic of Congo opposition leader Moise Katumbi meets the prosecutor today to answer allegations of recruiting foreign mercenaries.
All the newspapers talk about the recruitment of foreign mercenaries. The opinion in Lubumbashi, in the country, they are not believing that it can be possible for Mr. Katumbi to recruit mercenaries.
Gama Momba is one of the lawyers for Mr. Katumbi, a Harare pastor who uses videos to urge Zimbabweans to demand their rights, said his life has been threatened. In Douala, Cameroon, clean drinking water is in demand, and political violence in Zambia ahead of this year's election.
I think it's something which has been building in this country over the last few years, especially since the illness and ultimate demise of our late leader, President Michael Sata, and it just has to be brought under control.
Guy Scott is Zambia's former acting president and vice president. South Sudan's transitional government has had its first meeting. And what's behind the global shortage of yellow fever vaccine? Those stories plus Mark Ullman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Democratic Republic of Congo opposition leader Moise Katumbi meets the prosecutor today to answer allegations of recruiting foreign mercenaries. The government of President Joseph Kabila says it has documented proof that several former American soldiers are currently working for Mr. Katumbi as bodyguards in Katanga province. Mr. Katumbi last week accepted the petition of a coalition of seven opposition parties to challenge President Kabila in this year's election. Gama Momba, one of the lawyers for Mr. Katumbi, says many Congolese believe the government allegations are politically motivated.
Mr. Katumbi received the paper from the prosecutor calling him to come tomorrow to the office of the prosecutor. But on the paper the prosecutor sent, they don't mention the reason why he called him to go to the office of the prosecutor. I think tomorrow morning we are going to be informed on the right reason why the prosecutor called Mr. Katumbi.
But we did speak to the Minister of Information, and the Justice Minister has also been quoted as saying that the government wants to talk to Mr. Katumbi because he is being accused of recruiting mercenaries.
Yeah, the Minister of Justice talked about the recruitment of mercenaries, and the Minister of Information said the same. But now the case is in the court, and we need to know exactly what is the reason why the prosecutor called him. Because the government can say recruitment of mercenaries, but on the level of the prosecutor, they can change. So I can't confirm that we are going to face the same reason the Minister of Justice and the Minister of Information give us. But all the newspapers talk about the recruitment of mercenaries, and I think people are not believing in this. The opinion in Lubumbashi, in the country, they are not believing that it can be possible for Mr. Katumbi to recruit mercenaries.
Now, all this is coming when Mr. Katumbi has accepted a petition to run in the presidential election. So what do you think is behind all this? Why do you think the government wants to talk to him?
I think we can say that the case is in relation with the candidate of Mr. Katumbi. Because when the time Mr. Katumbi says he's going to become a candidate, the problem starts with the government. So this case is just a way to stop him to stand up on the presidential candidate.
There's a line here in the article I have that Mr. Katumbi has asked the United Nations mission in the DRC for protection. Is that true?
Yeah, the political group in which he belongs sent a letter to the United Nations locally to ask for the protection. Because when he resigned from the government, from the position of the governor of the province of Katanga, the government took all the soldiers, all the policemen who was keeping on him. So now he's living without protection from the government.
So Mr. Katumbi believes that this request by the prosecutor for him to come to be questioned is politically motivated.
The opinion in the country and outside are thinking that it's just a political case.
Gama Mumba is one of the lawyers for Congolese opposition leader Moise Katumbi. He was speaking with me from Lumumbashi. Former Zambian vice president and acting president Guy Scott says President Edgar Lungu does not stand a chance of being re-elected during the August presidential election. He cites the increasing number of ruling Patriotic Front party members, including himself, who have defected to the opposition UPND. Mr. Scott also criticized Zambian police for forcefully preventing a rally in Kitwe of the opposition UPND.
I think it's something which has been building in this country over the last few years, especially since the illness and ultimate demise of our late leader, President Michael Sata. And it just has to be brought under control. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of dubious electioneering in Africa in recent months, especially since the economic problem. There have been a lot of shortcuts and queries about the way elections were run. And I think there's a sort of temptation in the air to try and be forcible and try and press the issue. But I do believe we have to stop them. And I think it's going to come down to that in the next few weeks. Are we able to continue with our reputation as pretty much the only country in Africa which has overthrown two governments electorally, or three if you include the colonial government, to arrive where it is now?
Now, you've been vice president, acting president. It seems to me the party you once led, the PF, is really breaking apart. Is that a good characterization?
I think the word somebody used as he left it the other day was it has been hijacked. The original opposition, if you like. I mean, I hate to drag people through all this kind of nomenclature, but to put it simply, we came to power, that's we the PF, Mr. Sata and myself and various others, came to power in 2011 after beating the MMD, which was the original multi-party democracy leading party from 1991. What's happened now with the death of Mr. Sata is that the MND party has joined the PF, taken it over really, hijacked it, said that its people must be the members of parliament in future, and that people like me who are relics of the previous regime might as well go and hang.
A member of parliament from the Patriotic Front Party said that President Lungu will be re-elected because of the many development projects that have been undertaken in Zambia.
If he had said that about Michael Sata, and Michael Sata was still alive and fit, there might be some truth in it. That, of course, was the, well, that not of course, but that was the PF's strategy, long-term strategy, that we will do things for people and simply point at them when it comes to election time and say, well, there you are, that's what we did for you. But that didn't last very long, and I don't think you could really point to many that are in the course of being done at the moment. I think most of the gas has gone out of the machine, and maybe that's partly the world downturn and so forth, but I think the MP is being in question is being a bit optimistic.
If you were to tell the people of Zambia, why should they vote for Mr. Hichilema instead of President Lungu?
Well, I think they should probably vote for him because, first of all, he's not as far as we can establish, he is not a man who wants to divide our society into elites.
Guy Scott is former Zambian vice president and acting president. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. Today's Monday, May 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The South Sudan government says its forces are set to launch joint military operations with the Ethiopian army against suspected Mule gunmen who abducted more than 100 children from Ethiopia's Gambela region 2 weeks ago. John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports.
Information Minister Michael Makuei told journalists the decision was made at the first cabinet meeting of the Transitional Government of National Unity chaired by President Salva Kiir. Makuei says so far the Ethiopian government has sent its forces to the border with South Sudan and that the Ethiopian forces are working in collaboration with the South Sudan Army in a bid to rescue the children from the armed abductors.
Process with continuing efforts are still underway so that no operations are conducted against these people. But in lieu of that, then there is likelihood of conducting joint operations against whoever resists the order.
Makuei says South Sudan wants to resolve the matter through peaceful dialogue
but warns that the Ethiopian and the South Sudanese armies will be left with no option other than use of military force if the abductors do not comply and release the children. Makwi says a team of South Sudanese officials, including himself, Deputy Defense Minister David Yao Yao, and Boma state officials have been assigned to work with the Ethiopian government.
These people have joined the group in Addis. They are in Gambela. They met yesterday in Gambela, and probably they will be moving to Fashala and to Boma and Pibor today. This is in order to arrest the situation so that no operations are conducted against these people.
The South Sudan Information Minister says the government knows where the abducted children are located. He says officials also discuss the humanitarian situation of internally displaced persons residing in UN camps across the country after fleeing deadly fighting during the conflict. Makwi says the cabinet has ordered anybody who has occupied houses of the internally displaced persons to peacefully vacate, saying the IDPs have been voluntarily informed to move out of the camps and back to their various residences.
All those who are occupying houses of others illegally should move out of those houses immediately. In lieu of that, the security organs are authorized to take action against anybody who does not want to move out immediately. This is in order to ease the coming out of those who are at the POC site.
The government spokesman say the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs has been directed to oversee the departure and repatriation of the IDPs from UN camps to their various destinations. At least 200,000 IDPs are still residing in several sites manned by the United Nations across the country. Makwi says the cabinet also formed a committee that is now working on reviewing the matrix for the implementation of the peace agreement, which is behind schedule.
That was John Tanza of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reporting. Residents of Cameroon's largest city, Douala, are desperate for access to clean, drinking, potable water. Reporter Ntarike Devine Jr. reports.
It is nightfall at Bipanda, a populous neighborhood in Cameroon's largest city, Douala, crammed around one of the few available borehole water points. Are scores of women and children. They are in a boisterous scramble to fill their buckets with safe drinking water. The scenario mirrors the situation across urban Cameroon, where only 40% of residents enjoy access to drinkable water, according to UNICEF. Potable water as well as electricity supply shortfalls often force the authorities to resort to rationing, which is also unpopular. Yet, tourism promoters tout Cameroon as, quote, Africa in miniature, which boasts of favorable climate and fertile soils for agriculture, mineral resources, and a hydropower generation potential second only to the million inhabitants is once again raising eyebrows in several quarters, including among bishops of the Roman Catholic Church. Monseigneur Samuel Kleda is the president of the Episcopal Conference of Cameroon. He says it is not acceptable for the country's capital, Yaoundé, to be regularly deprived of water and electricity for several days and weeks. He wants the situation should serve as a wake-up call to the fact that something is critically wrong with the national government. The bishop's criticisms lend support to a report issued in June 2015 by the International Crisis Group warning of social discontent. It complained that the country lacks a strong opposition that would pressure the government to address social decay. From Douala in Cameroon, I'm Tarike Devine Jr. for VOA News.
A Harare pastor whose videos titled This Flag, Urging Zimbabweans to Demand Their Rights, have gone viral on social media, says he will continue to protest despite credible threats on his life. The 39-year-old pastor Evan Manwarere of the Generation Church is urging all Zimbabweans to carry their flags as a symbol of patriotism, stressing that history will judge the present generation harshly if it does not fight for their rights in Zimbabwe.
It started off through a little video I did, which I entitled This Flag. And I was sitting in my office, and I spent the day trying to raise school fees for my kids. And it hadn't worked out. I was so frustrated about the fact that I had failed to accomplish this task that every parent is supposed to be able to accomplish. So as I sat across my table, I looked at the Zimbabwe flag that sits on my desk. I looked at the flag, and the thought struck my mind that, you know, I feel like this country has stood in the way of every dream that I've tried to achieve and accomplish. And so it struck me as I looked at this flag that what the flag stands for and where the country is right now are worlds apart. These two things don't mean the same at all right now. So I did this little recording where I was lamenting the loss of the meaning of our national flag.
But some people might cringe. I watched the video myself and I said, this man is really brave. You know, judging from what happened to Zamara, for example, he disappeared last year. Are you not afraid?
I won't stand here and lie to you. I am very afraid because the history of people that have stood up to say certain things is not a very good one. But I find myself at a point where I am more afraid of a future that has nothing than a present that is completely shredded. So I said to somebody the other day who said, listen, I think you've gone too far and I think you need to slow it. I said, you know, one of the things I'm afraid of, I'm afraid that my children will judge me harshly. I am more afraid of the judgment of my children 10, 15, 20 years from now than I am of the possible action that this government may have. Whether I get arrested or whether I get abducted, I am more afraid that my children will judge me more harshly. I would rather have my children look at me and say, Dad, thank you for standing up. I'd rather have a generation of people say there was somebody who stood up and who challenged our politicians. I got a phone call. I've been threatened already. Someone called me and said that they would strangle me with the very flag that I'm holding, you know, and they were asking, you know, if you know, make a decision, you know, well, what are you? Are you a citizen? Are you a politician? Are you a pastor? Because if you don't, position yourself right with that very flag you're carrying around, your neck will be something that strangles you. And so it is both scary and infuriating that somebody who professes to be a Zimbabwean can threaten me to kill me with my own national emblem. It's absurd.
That was Pastor Evan Manwarere speaking from Harare with the Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. Angola is battling a yellow fever outbreak amid a global shortage of vaccine. Cases have also been reported in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Uganda, and China. Health experts worry about further spread. There's no treatment. Mass immunization is the only way to stop yellow fever. But as Jennifer Lesuta reports from Dakar, producing more of the vaccine is not easy.
The Institut Pasteur de Dakar is one of four places in the world that make the yellow fever vaccine. Recording is prohibited inside the institute, but there is nothing to hear. The halls are quiet. Two walls of windows separate us from sterile labs, where technicians work in head-to-toe protective gear. Each week, a carton of special pathogen-free chicken eggs arrives from Germany. Technicians inject the embryos one by one with the live virus. That's a first step. What follows is weeks of extraction, mixing, incubation, and safety checks. It can take up to 6 months to produce a batch of usable vaccine. Globally, around 80 million doses of yellow fever vaccine are made each year. The Institut Pasteur can produce up to 10 million doses. Antoine Marie Diatta is the quality control manager for yellow fever vaccine production at the Institute.
On est en capacité de produire une certaine quantité de vaccin, mais...
He says, unfortunately, our production capacity can't always meet the global needs. It's the same for other manufacturers, he says. This can be a problem when there is an epidemic, he says, because then there is an immediate need to vaccinate a large number of people. It can be hard to predict how much vaccine will be needed. Yellow fever vaccines can be stored for up to 3 years, but manufacturers can't afford to overproduce, as Diatta explains.
Le stockage du vaccin pour le producteur, c'est pas intéressant.
He says money is invested to make each batch of vaccine, and you must wait for your return. It's not easy. He says while you wait to sell, you still need to pay salaries and update equipment, but your money is tied up. Yellow fever is endemic to 34 countries in Africa. It is spread through the bite of an infected mosquito. A single dose of the vaccine can protect you for life. UNICEF's chief of child survival and development in Angola, Samson Agbo, says 80% of people living in high-risk areas need to be vaccinated to prevent an epidemic. In many parts of Africa, immunization rates are below 60%. Nearly 2,000 cases have been reported in Angola since the outbreak began in October 2015. A mass vaccination campaign was launched in February, using 6 million doses from emergency stockpiles. An additional 10 million doses were made available by the International Coordinating Group on Vaccine Provision and UNICEF in late March. While this has slowed the spread of the virus, the World Health Organization warns that if the outbreak spreads to other countries, the now depleted stockpiles could impact routine vaccination campaigns, putting millions more at risk. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's post. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with volleyball. Host Tunisia saw off Morocco in two straight sets to win the Africa Men's Beach Volleyball Championships in Kelibia, some 110 kilometers east of the capital, Tunis, on Sunday. Angola placed third, followed by Sierra Leone, Rwanda, Ghana, Mozambique, Gambia, Burundi, Egypt, and Ivory Coast in that order. Consequently, Tunisia qualified for the Men's Beach Volleyball Contest at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Morocco and Angola get another chance to qualify for Rio de Janeiro at an international Olympic qualifying tournament in July. In tennis, taking full advantage of home ground, Ones Jabeur bounced back with scores of 1-6, 6-2, 6-2 to beat Switzerland's Romina Oprandi to win the women's singles title at the WTA Nana Trophy in Tunis on Sunday. In football, the Democratic Republic of Congo host TP Mazembe pipped Tunisia's Stade Gabes Sien by a solitary goal in their Orange African Confederations Cup tie in Lubumbashi on Sunday. Early on Saturday, Tanzania's Young Africans dismissed Angola's Sagrada Esperanza 2-0, Algeria's MO Bejaia and Tunisia's Esperance drew 0-0, as did Mali's Stade Malien and Morocco's FUS Rabat. Sudan's El Merrekh pipped Morocco's Kaoukab 1-0, and South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns outwitted Ghana's Medeama 3-1. On Friday, Libya's El Ahli Tripoli and Egypt's Misri Makassar drew 0-0 as Etoile du Sahel from Tunisia beat Gabon's Munana 2-0. In athletics, world champion Asbel Kiprop clocked 3 minutes and 32.15 seconds to lead Elijah Manangoi and Silas Kiplagat in a 1-2-3 Kenyan triumph in men's 1500 meters at the IWF Diamond League in Doha, Qatar on Friday night. Similarly, world championship silver medalist Conseslus Kipruto clocked 8 minutes and 5.13 seconds to lead Jairus Birech and Abraham Kibiwot in a 1-2-3 Kenyan 3000 meters steeplechase dominance. Ethiopian Almaz Ayana triumphed in the women's 3,000 meters in 8 minutes and 23.11 seconds, the world's quickest time in the event this year. South African Caster Semenya ran the world's quickest women's 800 meters this year, clocking 1 minute and 58.26 seconds. On the infield, South African Sunet Fulyun won the women's javelin with a 65.14 meter effort. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Nearly 200 Somali migrants protested on Saturday after what they said was a racist video posted to the social media account of a member of Sweden's parliament. And that's it for this Monday, May 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouman, I'm James Butting in Washington, wishing all of you a very productive week.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Van Dee, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Next on Let's Talk. Boxing. Is it barbaric or a great sport? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing boxing. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.